And good morning, everyone, or good afternoon, or good evening. I mean, when you're talking to 156 countries, which is how many nations we are in tonight, this little small fledgling show. By the way, there's supposed to be a satellite pipe opened either tonight or tomorrow night to some amazing opportunities in broadcast land. And either later tonight or tomorrow, probably tomorrow, I will give you an update as to where we stand. But there's some pretty amazing things happening in the background vis-a-vis the show. So as I told my guest tonight, we have to kind of go back to square one because most of those folks in those 156 countries haven't a clue as to some of the things we're going to talk about tonight, so we have to begin with definitions. We're going to go celestial, as you can tell if you read the blurb on the show on the homepage tonight. Always go to theothersideofmidnight.com, theothersideofmidnight.com, and you can look at our guest listing. You can look for past guests. You can look over on the left. You see Club 19.5, that's the archive. You got to join the archive to understand the arcs of what we're doing in terms of various storylines. If you go to the upper left-hand corner of the homepage, again, theothersideofmidnight.com, there you will find the Twitter and the Facebook and the Google and the YouTube buttons. Facebook and Twitter are probably your most important right now, because if you log on to those, you can actually join the conversation. And as I said, you know, a couple nights ago, M kind of goes through those periodically, and she gleans some of the best questions. So she slips those to me through Skype, and I can read them on the air. So if you want a question asked that you can't get in by phone to ask, that's the one way to do it. And, of course, you know, the archive, Club 19.5, that is so important. It knits so many things together and makes various shows we're doing make sense when you listen to them in juxtaposition to other shows that we have done or are going to do. I mean, how can you listen to a show we're going to do? Well, I'll talk to Dean Radin about that. If you go to theothersideofmidnight.com and you go to Radio with Pictures, scroll down under My Items. As I said, we're going to talk about extraterrestrial things tonight. The last item under mine is Donald Trump's sudden visit to Mexico, hosted by the president of Mexico, the two of them standing there this afternoon, side by side. What the heck is going on? I mean, this president, Niente, I believe is his name, just a few weeks ago called Donald Trump Mussolini, and then he called him Hitler, or was it Hitler and then I forget which sequence. I mean, what happened this afternoon on live television is kind of comparable to if George Bush had invited Saddam Hussein to the White House. I mean, that's how nuts this is. Have I not told you for the last year that we have entered the Twilight Zone, that all the normal rules, all the normal associations, all the normal analyses are being left in the dust? This program is trying, in whatever way it can, to try to take the pieces and put them together into a new mosaic so we can see what's really going on. But the idea that the president of Mexico, who had vilified this Republican candidate for basically demeaning Mexicans in every way possible, then invites him to the capital of Mexico to stand next to him at a press conference and not dispute live any of the assertions that Donald Trump was making about what happened in this private meeting, only coming out in Twitter later, hours later, saying, oh, we didn't talk about this, and oh, I talked about that, and I brought up the wall. And in other words, none of this makes any sense. In any real-world politique, none of this makes any sense. Is it possible that since 1947, nothing in the world has made any sense? Think about that. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. And yes, we're going to grapple with some very amazing things that may have actually changed the timeline. We shall be back. And we are back on the other side of midnight. As I said, we're going to be talking celestial things this morning. So let me pick up with where I left off. If you go to Radio with Pictures and scroll down to item number one, the oldest fossils ever discovered have been discovered and published in a peer-reviewed paper in Nature this week. They are reported to be 3.7 billion years old. And the reason that's rather remarkable is because the oldest life earlier, which were also microbial mats of what are called stromatolites, a certain type of morphology of bacterial colonies, microbial colonies in ancient and current seas. The previous record holder was something like a quarter of a billion years younger. Now, why is this important? Because if life on Earth began at 3.7 billion years, and again, we're not looking at the beginnings of life, we're looking at very complex microbial organisms. So the precursors to those developed microorganisms had to be somewhere earlier, we don't know how long. But the time between these fossils, these little biological fossils, if that's what they are, and the consensus by the community is that's what they are, and the end of the so-called late heavy bombardment of the Earth itself, after its formation about 4.6 billion years ago, the solar system was busily mopping up all the debris in its so-called accretion disk. So planets, all of them including Earth, were hit by lots and lots of stuff. And when things hit of that scale and magnitude and at those velocities, it would have turned the surface of various planets into molten lakes, literally, with nothing dry and nothing cool to stand on for, you know, hundreds of millions of years. Well, the end of that period and the appearance of these fossils is only separated by 100 million years. Now, that sounds enormous, gargantuan, impossible to most people, but 100 million years in the concept of the universe with a 3.7 billion year lifetime and the Earth with a 4.6 billion year lifetime, you know, 100 million years is nothing. So what that means, and the reason it's important for tonight's discussion, it means that life, if you take the Earth as an example of one, life appeared on Earth almost before the ground was cool enough for the molecules to stick together. As one of the scientists said, paraphrasing, it looks like life will find a way wherever it is. Now that's important because of item number two. If you go down to Radio Pictures, scroll down under my items, look at item number two. Remember that radio signal the Russians suddenly, kind of a year after they found it, kind of came out in conversations. It was leaked to, I guess, some SETI researcher, and there's now going to be a discussion in the next couple of months at some major SETI conference. Well, the Russians came out today, and they basically said that their analysis shows that it was a terrestrial noise. It was a signal from Earth, had nothing to do with this G-type sun-like star 94, 95 million light years away. But the fact that it's front and center in the news, both arguing against and arguing for, the fact that news stories looking at our origins has now been pushed back about another quarter of a billion years to where the Earth was bringing forth life almost before it was hospitable enough. I mean, all this is arguing that, in fact, even if this signal was not real, the chances are that somewhere out there in the galaxy or beyond, there's a lot of other folks that may be doing what the SETI model is saying, and they're listening or looking to the skies with their own radio telescopes, and they're sending signals. Well, the other possibility, which needs to be seriously considered, is that all our approach to SETI, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, is kind of mired in an archaic perspective that says that the only way to communicate between the stars is by EM radio transmissions, and all other science or all other discussions of science is kind of irrelevant. We're going to talk about one of those irrelevancies because it's possible, very possible, that the reason that the SETI folks are not picking up any signals is because they're as extinct in terms of technologies as the dodo bird. In other words, One would never imagine using radio to send signals across interstellar space because it's quicker and cheaper and easier to just go there. And that's where my guest tonight comes in. Thomas J. Carey is a native Philadelphian, holds degrees from Temple University and the California State University at Sacramento. He also attended the University of Toronto's PhD program in anthropology. An Air Force veteran who held a top-secret crypto clearance, Tom is now a retired Philadelphia-area businessman, and he's been a Mutual UFO Network MUFON State Section Director for southeastern Pennsylvania from 1986 to 2001. He was also a special investigator for the J. Allen Hynek Center for UFO Studies from 1991 to 2001, and a member of the CUFO's Board of Directors from 1997 to 2001. Tom began investigating aspects of the Roswell incident back in 91 for the Roswell investigative team of Kevin Randall and Don Schmidt. Since 1998, he has teamed exclusively with Don Schmidt to continue a proactive investigation of the Roswell case. Tom has authored or co-authored more than 40 published articles about Roswell and the events in 1947, and has contributed to an untold number of books on the subject as well. He's appeared as a guest on many radio and TV shows, including Coast to Coast and Fox and Friends, Comcast, and many, many others. Anyway, without further ado, welcome to The Other Side of Midnight, Tom Carey.
Nice to be with you, Richard.
Well, let's see. Go ahead.
In Pennsylvania, we are really on the other side of midnight right now.
You're about 3 a.m. over there right now, I think.
Yes.
Why is it everybody these days, we live in a 24/7 culture. When I approach certain people, Tom, and I say, would you like to be on the show? Then I tell them the times. They look at me as if I had basically said I was a Martian. I mean, it's like, for some reason, people still think we live in this, you know, 9 to 5 and weekends off and, you know, 2-week vacations. And that's not the world we're living in anymore. So welcome literally to the other side.
Thank you so much. You are absolutely correct about that. You get into the being retired. I don't have those constraints. So I did when your producer said the time slot. I did take a step back for a second, but being that it was you, I said, "Oh well."
Well, thank you so much.
I will do it.
I mean, come on, you're only in 156 countries tonight, so there is an upside. And a lot of people listen not live, but they listen through the ARCA, through Club 19.5, because it meets their schedule and all that. Okay, for all those people out there that haven't ever heard of Roswell, and there are a lot of people, Tom, let's back up and let's see, do I want to go directly to Roswell? No, I guess I want to talk to you about how the heck did you, with all this background, including, you know, MA and PhD in anthropology, how the heck did you get involved in UFOs?
Well, you know, when you were giving that brief history of the Earth's life's origins, it took me way back to when I had historical geology and the beginnings of life on Earth. It brought back a lot of memories, but I've always been interested in UFOs since I was a teenager, and there was something about it. I guess it was the mystery. It was the mystery of what are these things that are flying around in our skies that our Air Force, with the latest jet-propelled aircraft, cannot seem to get a hold of. And I'm trying to think. The first book I believe I read was the Ruppelt book.
Oh, classic.
The Report on Unidentified Flying Objects, I think is what the title was. Edward Ruppelt was the first director of Project Blue Book in the early 1950s. And that book was very, very interesting. And I still remember the first sentence in the book. It said something to the effect, in 1952, a United States Air Force F-86 fighter jet fired at an unidentified flying object. I believe that was the first sentence in the book. It stuck with me all these years. And the next book that Kehoe was my favorite author. I just loved Donald E. Kehoe. He was the civilian former Marine Corps major. That was the public advocate for having congressional hearings, et cetera, on the subject of UFOs. And he wrote several outstanding books on the subject. But in 1980, a book came along called The Roswell Incident. And it was about, not about lights in the sky, not about what people said they saw up close, but that, you know, there was no evidence. It just sort of almost will-o'-the-wisps, some of these things were. But this book, 1980 book, was about an alleged crash of one of these flying saucers, as they used to call them. Nuts and bolts. See, I'm sort of a nuts and bolts type of guy. You know, just the facts, ma'am, that sort of thing.
Well, we both grew up in Jack Webb, of course.
We cite him in the beginning of
every book. Yes. Well, let me ask you this. From what my reading is, and of course I lived through some of this, so I remember it vividly, but most of the UFO stuff was all about distant things in the sky, or a few people like Adamski who went out in the desert and claimed he had arranged meetings and all that. But again, things in the sky. The Roswell event was such a break because it was basically pieces on the ground that an official arm of the U.S. government had not only gone out and investigated, but then, according to the story, they proceeded to very effectively close off every avenue of further investigation. It suddenly was not airy-fairy lights in the sky. It was real metal on the ground.
Nuts and bolts, plus some biological material was part of the story. And back in 1947, I sent some photo images along to your producer. I don't know if she's showing them or not. But...
Oh, no, no. We have everything up on Radio with Pictures. All you have to do is go to your computer, go to theothersideofmidnight.com,
right.
Click on Radio with Pictures, that icon next to my picture. That takes you to your page. Scroll down where it says...
Let's see here. I have... I'm on this. I printed out the pictures anyway, so I know what they are.
Okay, so you know what the sequence is, right?
Yes, yes.
Okay, so we're looking on, again, Radio with Pictures. Theothersideofmidnight.com. Click on Radio with Pictures. That takes you to this page. Scroll down under your items. Number one is a collage of newspaper headlines from the summer of 47 chronicling the arrival of flying saucers in the post-World War II era.
Yes, it's one of those things because, I believe we both believe that the sightings, if that's what we want to call them, have taken place for millennia, more than likely. But for some reason, 2 years after the close of World War II, they burst upon the scene in the United States especially, but all over the world, in late June of 1947, all of a sudden, starting with the famous Kenneth Arnold sighting in Washington State near Mount Rainier, where he claimed to have seen 12 V-shaped objects skipping along in the air at a high rate of speed, sort of when asked by the press, what did they look like? He said they look like saucers skipping across a pond, and thus the term flying saucer was coined.
An amazing phrase.
So that's late June, but you can see in that collage of headlines from various newspapers, flying saucers were front page news, at least throughout our country at that time. What are these things flying around? You can see from the headlines there, Flying discs continue to baffle U.S. So
mystery object seen in 38 states. British severely skeptical of America's flying saucers. That indicates it was a phenomenon just of this country or this continent, as opposed to the rest of the world at that time.
Yes. And so 2 weeks later, you know, there's this, you know, what is this going on here? What is this going on? Going to the next image.
Okay.
We have the flying saucer, an alleged flying saucer crash near Roswell, New Mexico. Well, to people living west of the, say, you know, for a demarcation line, west of the Mississippi, it was a two-day story because press release went out from the Roswell Air Base around noontime on July the 8th, 1947. It went around to the local two local newspapers, two local radio stations. No such thing as commercial TV on a regular basis at that time.
So, what about AP and UPI?
As soon as it got on, it got on the AP wire. That's what made it a worldwide story. And it finally got on the UP wire, but it got on the AP wire first and went around the world. And so west of the Mississippi, they had this press release from the Air Force that they had recovered. Somehow it got into the press that they captured. Well, they didn't capture it. They recovered. They recovered a flying saucer.
Right.
So that was the first story. Well, later on, just a few hours later, in the afternoon of July the 8th, this is now like 3 or 4 hours after the press release was sent out, you have the next higher command from the Roswell base, would be the 8th Air Force in Fort Worth, Texas, declaring, well, it wasn't, folks, sorry, wasn't a flying saucer from another world. It was, what was that thing? A weather balloon.
So that's link number 3 under radio with pictures under your on your page.
Well, first you see the one that says Army has flying disc. That was the headline west of the Mississippi. Because the press release didn't go out until noontime, Roswell time, where all of the daily, the morning newspapers had already run. So if you were an afternoon newspaper west of the Mississippi, you had gotten the story in time for that evening. But east of the Mississippi, those papers were already in print. It was too late. So the next day, that the results of this press release, this press conference in Fort Worth, you see in the third image there, Army debunks Roswell flying disc as world simmers with excitement. Mm. So you can imagine everybody's going, oh my goodness, what next? Oh man, we got to hear more about this, because the original press release didn't say a whole lot other than it was going to higher headquarters, which was Fort Worth. And so the big mistake was for the Air Force was, had they said it was that the people at Roswell had mistaken our latest fighter aircraft or research plane with strange alloys for something otherworldly, we wouldn't be talking tonight, Richard. We would not be talking tonight. But they went a bridge too far with this weather balloon story.
No, wait, back up. In other words, why would we have accepted a crash of an aircraft, but we didn't accept the crash? Because people did accept the weather balloon for up until, what was it, who broke the story in the 80s? I mean, this was not a new story. This was an ancient cold case resurrected over the objections of the official story.
Well, I'm just saying that had the press conference said, well, folks, the guys over there at Roswell, they weren't familiar with, you know, we're testing out this new Douglas skyrocket or something like that, and it has new alloys in it. That story would have been accepted by the general public to a greater degree than this weather balloon.
Because wait. You were in the Air Force. Why do you think they didn't go that route?
Well, that's been a object of discussion for decades, Richard. Why did they choose a weather balloon? We don't know for sure. We can only speculate on it.
I tell you, hold it there. Let's speculate after the break. We're at the bottom of the hour. My guest this morning is, who was my guest this morning? I'm having a brain whatever. It's awful. Tom Carey. Sorry, Tom. You know why that happened to me? I have a very good friend who lives in Pennsylvania, the other side of the state, named Tom Carey. Same spelling, same Tom, same everything. So, anyway, we're at the bottom of the hour. We shall return. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. Don't go away. Back. Welcome back to the other side of midnight. You know, this song is so appropriate. Listen to these lyrics. This is what the other side of midnight is all about. So for the last 60, 70 years, we've been chasing this rabbit called Roswell. Tom, do you think you finally captured it? Do you think you finally understand what happened in Roswell all those years ago?
Oh, yes, certainly. I wanted to finish that question you had asked me about why was it accepted. Well, back in 47, there was television, but almost nobody had TV, so you didn't have nightly round tables kicking things around. So most people got their news from the daily newspaper. And the mainstream newspapers never have liked flying saucers. They have never liked it. They might have a story once a year about UFOs, but it's always tongue-in-cheek, you know? Hmm. So
Was this always from the very beginning, Kenneth Arnold, et cetera? I mean, it seems to me they were very forthright about covering something unbelievable at that time. And then there was a shift. And was it the Robertson panel that caused the shift?
No, it was actually before that. I mean, they dropped the Roswell story the second day, right after the weather balloon explanation, as if, wow, how could these fellas over at Roswell? Now, this is our elite military unit that we have. They ended World War II by dropping two atomic bombs on Japan. The 509th Bomb Group, which is what we're talking about at Roswell, they're still in existence today, and their mission is the same, to drop atomic devices in time of war. That was our elite unit. And why the explanation was accepted, I believe, was that in 1947, our military, having just won World War II against the Axis powers, was perhaps held in its highest esteem by our citizens at that time. And they tended to believe, well, if our military said it, it must be true. So I think that's what went on. And also the press, they were eager, at least in my opinion, to drop this story because they don't like dealing in things like this. We call it today the paranormal. It's something in that paranormal category. So they dropped it quickly. And if it's not in the press, well, the story went away, because I've had a numbers of witnesses tell me that, it was in the press that it was a weather balloon, so that was it. You know, they didn't follow it that closely, but when the debunking story came out, they said, "Oh well, that must be it." Okay, so it went away for 31 years.
In another era, later, up until the 1970s, you know, I worked in networks. I worked for CBS, worked for NBC, worked for ABC, all of them at one time or another. John Chancellor, when he was going to break a major story, I forget, it was about Vietnam, he got a personal phone call from Johnson, President Johnson, and he did not run the story. I can imagine, maybe you can too, if the Air Force really wanted to keep what they found under wraps, all they had to do was call a few editors, AP, a couple of the big papers, and it would have been quietly silenced on the altar of national security. Because back then, long before Chancellor and, you know, Johnson had their conversation, what the government said basically went. It was like gold. It was like a gold standard. The government did not lie to you then, right?
It's different today for the most part. But back then, you're absolutely right. You had three or four radio networks. You had a couple big papers, again, the New York Times, Chicago Tribune, things like that. And all you had to do was make a phone call.
Yep.
But my belief was that the papers, even back then, wanted to drop this. When someone gave them the out, they took it. And with people, when the story stopped being reported upon, that was it. It died. It was, like I said, it was a two-day story, and it died for 31 years until 1978, when Jesse Marcel Sr., the base intelligence officer of this elite group, 509th Bomb Group, he was the first military person out at the crash site. He broke his silence because to kill the story, Richard, they had to address three groups. The first one was the press, to kill that story in the press, which they did in 2 days. The second group was to silence the military personnel who were involved in the recovery. And that was fairly easy because they were under the command.
They were all under orders, yes.
They were all under orders, and they were threatened with Leavenworth prison if they spoke. So that was an easy one also. The third group, and the most difficult to control, was the local citizenry who got out to the crash site, knew what had happened, had seen things, and as someone told me a few years ago, the story got around town, Roswell, within 20 minutes. Once some of the witnesses got back, it went around town in 20 minutes. So that was the group that had to be controlled. And it was difficult legally because the military can only control civilians, A, in time of war, or B, in time of martial law has been declared. And neither one had obtained in this instance. But they did it anyway. They sent military officers around.
Hang on. Let's not get ahead of our story because I want to do this kind of sequentially. Again, for a lot of people around the world who don't know what Roswell is, if you want to go back to Radio with Pictures, look at image number 5. That is the famous Major Jesse Marcel, who broke his silence in 1978 after an event that happened 31 years earlier. So what happened after he broke his silence in 78?
Yes, I just want to point out the image 4, you can see that's a picture from the press conference. You see the weather balloon at General Roger Ramey's feet. He's the commanding officer of the 8th Air Force, and his adjutant, Thomas Jefferson Dubose, plus the broken up weather balloon and radar target made out of tinfoil.
I love this caption. General Roger M. Ramey's weather balloon press conference, announcing it was not a spaceship recovery by the dopes at Roswell, thus killing the story for the next 31 years. In other words, the upper commands of the Air Force basically said, those turkeys over in Roswell who are flying around with atomic bombs and can incinerate the world at a moment's notice, They don't know what's up in the sky, and they haven't a clue what they actually found.
They can't tell the difference between balsa wood, tin foil, and rubber, and an interplanetary or a extraterrestrial spaceship.
There was no independent press to say, are you guys nuts?
Right.
There was no counter voice. There was no, Fox News. There was nothing. It was two major wire services and a couple of networks.
You got it.
Okay, let's go down to Marcel. Let's see what Marcel looks like.
So Marcel, he's the head of intelligence.
For the Roswell Army Air Force Base.
Yes, for the 509th Bomb Group. And he was the first military person out at the site, along with a counterintelligence officer, a Captain Sheridan Cavett. Well, they kept their silence for 31 years. But he was a ham operator living in Houma, Louisiana. And he started saying he had emphysema. He didn't know how much longer he had left to live. And this is 1978.
Right.
So he started talking about...
Was there some precipitating incident? Did he see something on television? Was there some news story that suddenly made him say, I can't sit on this any longer?
Not in 1978, no. Not at that time, no.
So it was just his health problems and the fact that he knew something amazing. He knew that the lie had been promulgated and he didn't want to leave until he corrected the record.
Correct. So he had spoken of it on his little ham radio network.
Oh.
And a fellow by the name of Stanton Friedman.
Yes, Stanton is a fellow, definite fellow.
Friend of mine, yes.
Likewise.
Stan. And he was in Louisiana for I think he was doing a radio or television interview or he was down there
now,
for
folks who don't know, again, over in Thailand who are listening tonight, Stanton Friedman is a nuclear physicist. He worked back in the 40s and 50s and 60s on all kinds of very highly classified programs with the cutting edge of technology, nuclear aircraft and all that. He got a bee up his bonnet sometime in the 70s about UFOs, actually even before, and he started looking and looking and looking. So you're saying that he was at the right place at the right time to hear about Marcel talking about this stuff.
Yes, the producer of the whatever show he was on said, hey, Stan, we have a guy here who says he handled pieces of a flying saucer. Maybe you want to talk to him. So he gave him Marcel's name and phone number. And before he left Louisiana, he called him and, felt, hey, I'm going to interview this guy a little further when I get back home. And thus began, in 1978, the civilian investigation of the Roswell incident. There was also another fellow who called Marcel as well, named Leonard Stringfield, who had been he lived in Cincinnati, Ohio. He is a businessman, also interested in UFOs, and being close to Dayton, where Wright-Patterson Air Force Base was, he had heard a number of stories coming out of Wright-Patterson of these strange things that were being stored on the base.
Stringfield was a civilian, but I talked to him once. Interesting guy, fascinating guy. At a time when no one else wanted to touch this, Stringfield actually went out and talked about and wrote about and gathered evidence together about the Air Force retrieving flying saucers, retrieving things from the sky, which was so heretical back then.
See, and yes, exactly. And the reason was the chief advocate in the late 1940s and into the 1950s, again, was Donald E. Kehoe. But Kehoe wouldn't touch stories about crashed UFOs because it was too close to these. You remember the contactees, Richard, who claimed to have been friends of our space brothers who would drive
George Adamski and a whole bunch of people like him out in the California desert.
Howard Menger and those people. Kehoe stayed away from crash stories about crashed UFOs. He wouldn't get within a 10-foot pole. So it was up to Stringfield, who gathered that information, plus Stan Friedman, who fortuitously was in the right place at the right time.
I'll bet Stanton looks back now and he says, my gosh, if I hadn't been in Louisiana that afternoon. Because yes. It changed his life.
Yes.
It totally changed Stan's life.
Absolutely. Well, it changed mine. I've been on this case for 25 years.
Okay, how did you get into this? Because you have the background, Air Force, anthropology, you know, mainstream science. How did you get wrapped up in Roswell? Because, A, remember, we're talking about an era where even thinking about crash stuff and things on the ground, you know, sweet dreams and pieces right. on the ground, was totally, totally heretical. How did you make the decision to get into the maelstrom?
Well, I was interested. It was something about this particular subject clicked with me. I'm not interested in lights in the sky. I'm not interested in, did you see that thing? It was real up close, but it didn't leave it. This was this nuts and bolts. It's like archaeology, nuts and bolts. You archaeologists, they look for physical evidence of past civilizations and peoples. This case had it all. It had nuts and bolts. It had biological bodies, let's call them.
Mm-hmm.
Also had a cover-up. It had threats.
It had everything.
It had everything. And that's why it's not only the granddaddy of all UFO cases, it's the most interesting case of all time.
So so Stan was living, what, in Maine then or in Canada?
I believe he was still in the U.S. at that time. I think he moved to New Brunswick a little later on.
Okay. So he got home and he called this guy.
Yes, and he teamed up with William Moore, who had written a book about the Philadelphia Experiment. I had already written that book. He was a investigator of, I don't even like the term paranormal. I just don't like
it. I don't either. We have banned the term paranormal from the show.
Yes, I don't like it either. He had done the Philadelphia Experiment book.
I was on a couple of panels with William Moore. He was very controversial. In fact, at some point, didn't someone accuse him of being a double agent or something?
Yes. He's been accused. He may have been a quasi-double agent, is what I get out of it. He had this friend, Richard Doty. And
the Air Force guy here at Kirkland.
Yes. And it's just even when I talk about it, I start getting queasy. you know what I mean? But the thing was, William Moore, he did good work and he was a good writer. I enjoy what he did.
Oh, he's a great writer.
Yes.
Without him companioning with Stanton, we would not know the Roswell story. So you got to give him whatever his background, whatever he was doing, whoever he was being paid for. He brought the story out in a form that a whole bunch of us, you included, could kind of take a look at. So that's when they brought that book out, and that's what got you going,
Yeah. I said, this is great. This is great. Well, you know what happened after that book came out, Richard, was nothing happened again for 10 years. Moore wrote a few update articles, but you had to be into UFOs to know where to find them. They were in the MUFON journal, I believe they were, and when MUFON had their yearly symposia, he would have perhaps a long article or two, an update, you know. And but for as far as books are concerned, there was nothing until 1991 when this is when I became involved in 1991. I was I signed up with QFOS to get their monthly journal, and I read
this,
about
the, these, this was the Hynek organization in Chicago.
J. Allen Hynek, the former scientific consultant to Blue Book, and there were these two fellas, Kevin Randall and Don Schmidt, who were reopening the Roswell case. Now, this is about 1989, 1990. I said, some more stuff about Roswell, finally.
Hmm.
And one of the stories about the case was that the crash itself was discovered by a team of archaeologists from the University of Pennsylvania. Well, at the time, I was living just outside of Philadelphia.
Oh.
In Huntington Valley, which is where I still live, And my background was in archaeology and anthropology. I said, oh, my goodness, I should be able to help out here. So I called up Kevin, and I said, hey, what have you guys been doing about the team of archaeologists that allegedly had stumbled upon this down-crashed UFO? He said, well, we interviewed one or two people, but we really didn't get anything out of them, and we basically haven't done anything more about it. So I said, listen, I live just outside of Philadelphia. I have a background in anthropology and archaeology. Let me go down to the University of Pennsylvania and see what I can find out. So that's in February of 1991, and my initial involvement.
So you were basically offering to these guys the most important part of any investigation, which is someone willing to do all the grunt work and the slog work and the door-to-door and the totally unglamorous stuff that gets you the real scoop.
Right, right. And you know yourself, Richard, we've had a lot of, not a lot, but a number of people say, oh, how can I help you? Let me help you. Give me something to do. And so we give them something to do, and we never hear from them
again. No, they run screaming for the door of the library. Ah.
What's intimidating is when you have to call up somebody, it's a cold call, and you want to call them up about flying saucers.
Yes.
It's very daunting, and like I said, 99% of those people we never hear from again. But, and even myself, even today, Richard, when I know I have to make some cold calls, I have to psych myself up. I have to psych myself up to do it, because you don't know if they're going to laugh at you, slam the phone down in your ear, or what.
Hmm.
But I do understand the daunting task of making these cold phone calls. But
so obviously, being in the Air Force, you never learned, do not volunteer. You volunteered. What did you find?
Well, I went down to the University Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology. I went through the literature, and I found, because we were looking for a certain anthropologist who was on the – see, we thought at that time that the craft itself had crashed on the plains of San Augustine.
Mm-hmm.
We no longer believe that, but we were looking for this certain archaeologist named Buskirk that was thought by Moore and Friedman to have led this archaeological team.
Well, wouldn't the university have had records who was out doing field work here, there, that kind of thing?
Well, those would been they would be in individual notes and what have you. But what I did is I went to the card catalogs. They don't now we have the internet, but right. Back then they didn't have it. So I went to the card catalogs, looked up Buskirk, and there he was.
Wow,
he had a book called. He was from Albuquerque. The age was right, and. What's his name? Gerald Anderson, who was he came forward after a 1989 Unsolved Mysteries show about Roswell, and said that he was there as a 5-year-old. He even drew one of these police identikit sketches of the archaeologist.
Hmm.
And, so I went to the stacks and I got this book. It was called Living with the Land Up to 1950. It was a history of the an Indian tribe
this
out
is,
there.
This is Buskirk's book.
Yes.
The anthropologist from the University of Pennsylvania who lived in Albuquerque.
Well, it turns out he was from the University of New Mexico.
Oh.
But he matched. They had a picture of him. I had to send away for the dust cover because the book didn't have the dust cover. So I sent away to the University of Kansas for the dust cover, and it had the picture. You know, on the fly leaf, they had the picture of the author.
Sure.
And he was older, but it was a match.
Match to the sketch.
Yes.
Wow.
And so he was still alive. I called him up.
Amazing.
Yes. And he said, no, I was not in New Mexico in the summer of 47. I was in Arizona working on my PhD at the Apache Reservation. And I believed him. And to make a long story short, Gerald Anderson turned out to be a hoaxer. And it, what happened was he had this Buskirk fellow. They taught anthropology at his Albuquerque High School, and Buskirk was his teacher. And that's where he cooked up this story where Buskirk was the leader of this archaeological group, and they stumbled upon the crash site.
Okay, question. Why? Yeah. Why would someone make up such a story? What would they get out of it?
Well, again, this is all speculation, Richard. And it turns
sounds
out,
like disinformation to me.
Yes, we interviewed his wife, his former wife, and it turns out he was a ne'er-do-well, is what we call it. He was a ne'er-do-well. And we've come across a number of them, Richard, that it gives them it puts them in the limelight, which he certainly was in the limelight. I mean, he was interviewed by everybody, and he was a phony. He was an absolute phony. He said he was a Navy SEAL. He was not. A Navy SEAL. According to his wife, he was a cook.
Well, the reason this is important is because he steered everybody in the wrong direction.
Absolutely.
Looking for an academic field team that could have corroborated all kinds of cool things about Roswell, and it turns out he made it all up.
We spent 2 years on him. That we could have been spending elsewhere when witnesses were still alive. And the Plains of San Augustine crash, since he was the only other quote-unquote witness to the Plains of San Augustine was a fellow by the name of Barney Barnett, who was a soil conservation engineer. And he is the only witness, alleged witness, to this huge event, which, unlike the Roswell case, where we have over 600 witnesses on the record, everything about the Plains of San Augustine got back to Barney Barnett, who appeared by all standards to be a straight shooter, but you would think there would be more witnesses coming forward, or us digging out and finding.
I tell you what, hold it there. We're at the top of the hour.
There aren't any.
My guest this morning, Tom Carey, we're going over the Roswell story, and we're giving you background because I want to get to his book, because he's taken an attack on this story, this amazing story that is so important. He's followed the children of Roswell. What happened to the families? What happened to parents and sons and daughters when the government comes in and basically says, if you don't keep your mouth shut, it's a very big desert out there? And that was actually said to several people. So we'll continue with this. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and don't go away. And welcome back, everyone, on the other side of midnight. I'm talking with Tom Carey. We're talking about one of the most remarkable UFO incidents in history because it left stuff. It left tons of engineers and witnesses and academics and Air Force and military people all talking about something that, when you kind of distill it down, we're still not quite sure what happened. We know something happened, but we're not quite sure. If you want to join the conversation, if you want to send us a question, send me a question, which I can in turn read for Tom, you can go to the upper left-hand corner of our homepage, theothersideofmidnight.com, click on Facebook or on Twitter and join the conversation that way, and send in a question, and we'll be taking a look, and she'll relay the most interesting ones to me. So, Tom, we probably should get to the overall impact of these books, because there was a real spike of interest in Roswell in the 80s and 90s and 2000s. And that spurred some official action by the Air Force, didn't it?
Yes. The book, in, at least in my opinion, the book that really kick-started, the the 1980 book, of course, was the seminal, you know, the first one. But the book that really kicked the door open was the Randall and Schmidt book from 1991 called UFO Crash at Roswell. And from that book flowed the first motion picture called Roswell in 1994. And several other movies, not as good as the Showtime movie Roswell. Hmm. It also, I mentioned the 1989 Unsolved Mysteries devoted almost a whole show to Roswell. And so Roswell was out there, and some of the constituents of New Mexico Congressman Stephen Schiff in 1993, since the door is now open and it's being discussed, they tasked Stephen Schiff to find out what's going on with Roswell. So what he did was he went to the Department of Defense. Now, he wasn't trying to solve the case. He was trying to determine if the documents that had to be produced, you know, from the air bases, say, at Fort Worth and at Roswell and Washington, if those correspondences and documents that flowed back and forth were properly classified. That's what he was trying to do.
For his constituents?
Yes.
And
yes.
What year was this again?
1993.
Ah, okay.
2 years after the Randall and Schmidt book came out, and just before the movie, Roswell, came out in 1994. So he went to the Department of Defense, and he felt he was getting the runaround because they sent him over to the archives, the National Archives, and they said, "What are you doing here? You got to go back to the Department of Defense." So he says, "Okay, I'll fix him." So he put the GAO, the General Accounting Office, as it was called then. It's now called the Government Accountability Office, but it's the investigative arm of Congress. He put the GAO on the trail of trying to find documents relating to the Roswell incident of 47 to see if they had been properly classified and stored. And lo and behold, it turns out the result of the investigation was that all of those documents had been destroyed.
Oh, my God. Hold it there. We're at 5 after the hour. So all the evidence he was looking for, the paper trail, as it's called in any good investigation, had very conveniently been destroyed. Wow. You're on the other side of midnight. We'll come back with Tom Carey, so don't go away. Music's playing. And welcome back to The Other Side of Midnight. My guest this morning is Tom Carey. In the background is Joe Walsh. Life's been good. So, Tom, we're talking about Stephen Schiff, who's a congressman literally from over the hill, because I used to pick up mail at the Stephen Schiff post office annex many years after Stephen died of cancer. He developed an incredibly fast, galloping form of cancer. He was gone almost like Tom Van Flandern. I mean,
it was skin cancer and very virulent, and he was gone in a heartbeat.
It was months, just months.
Yes.
So he found that all the records that he was trying to the GAO to find on Roswell through the Army Air Base and what went on in Texas, all of that had been destroyed?
Yes, and what's interesting is that it was destroyed at date unknown by unknown authority. Now, Richard, you know, if you've ever been in the military, you can't go to the bathroom without having authority. Right?
Yeah. Well, they used to have a phrase in the Navy, you know, if it moves, salute it. If it doesn't, paint it.
Well, they didn't do any of that with the Roswell documents. Without authority that ship could find, and a date of that it was destroyed, there was none of that. It just, everything was gone.
Without any attribution, any paper train up the trail of command, up the chain of command.
Correct. Amazing. Correct.
Now, did he find any other incidents in U.S. military history where that was done?
I don't know that he's researched anything.
Someone
like that
should now, because if you could say that Roswell was unique in American military history, you'd really have a case for something bizarre went on that was not just a weather balloon.
Well, I do know for a fact that there are still documents relating to Pearl Harbor that are still under wraps, and those have to do with the codes, the code breaking.
Right.
So, but they have not been destroyed. So this may be it's the only one that I'm aware of where documents like that have been destroyed. Without a known authority directing that.
So let's look at this. Some 30, 40 years later, a congressman here in New Mexico, at his constituents, because they obviously read all the books and were very excited about Roswell, they asked their congressman, look into this and find out what happened. And he tries to look into it, and he finds that all the records have been destroyed. And then a few months later, he gets cancer, and a few months after that,
he's
dead.
Gone. Yep.
So there's a pattern here of not only destroying evidence, but threatening witnesses. We're going to get back to that because that's a very important point, and it leads off to your book, Children of Roswell.
Yes. The other thing to remember about this investigation, Richard, was that the Air Force at that time took it upon themselves to, quote-unquote, reinvestigate the Roswell incident. In 1994.
Are we talking about time compression?
Yes.
Tell people what that led to.
How did you guess? they took it upon themselves. They cherry-picked a few witnesses, like Sheridan Cavett, who lied from beginning to end. He told lie after lie after lie. And so he was one of the witnesses they interviewed. And the Air Force came up with this Project Mogul explanation, saying that, well, folks, we did lie to you back in 1947. It was not a weather balloon. It was a series of weather balloons that was going up into the stratosphere, pulling an acoustic sensor to try to listen in on what might be the Soviet Union's first detonation of atomic bomb. And the problem with that, because oh my goodness, Project Mogul, that must be it. Yeah, that was it. But what it was, Project Mogul was still rubber weather balloons, balsa wood holding together these tin foil radar targets. There were a lot of them, but it was still rubber, balsa wood, and tin foil, and so.
And how could that possibly account for that Roswell Daily Record headline, Army has crashed disc?
Right, because weather balloons don't crash. They burst and then they come down and land mostly intact. They don't create a field a mile long and a couple hundred feet wide full of pieces of strange metal.
That was how big the debris field was?
Yes, it was actually three quarters. The dimensions usually given are three quarters of a mile long by 300 feet wide. It was a sheep pasture, and it was chock full of these little pieces of metal type debris when the ship exploded over the J.B. Foster Ranch, which Mac Brazel, a fellow by the name of Mac Brazel, was the foreman. And so a weather balloon, no matter how many of them you have, cannot account for that, because balloons, when they crash, they don't crash. They come down after they burst, and they pretty for the most part they stay in one piece. And the same with the tinfoil radar targets. You can a 6-year old can recognize balsa wood, especially back in those days. Kids would put together these balsa wood airplanes. That was the big thing. So, if you call up the Air Force today, that is their story, that it was Project Mogul. And then 3 years later, now this is the real thing, is 3 years later was 1997, which was the 50th anniversary of the Roswell crash. Well, by this time, it's really big stuff. It made the cover of Time magazine. I don't know if you remember that or not.
I remember. And Larry King did specials from Roswell.
Yes, they had wall-to-wall coverage on CNN. On July the 4th, 1997, in the celebration of the Roswell incident, wall-to-wall, all day long from Roswell, Time magazine, everybody was writing about Roswell. And you would have to say, Richard, that in the history of the investigation and the post-crash period, that 1997 July 4th weekend was the pinnacle of interest in the case.
Do you know what else was happening that same weekend, that same year, 1997, July 4th? The NASA mission to Mars called Pathfinder.
Oh, yes.
And the little rover called Sojourner. And we got live images from Mars, which showed amazing stuff until they stopped the feed, and then we never got live stuff again.
Right.
That's a whole other story. But, you know, 97, yes, July of 97 was a pinnacle of something.
Yes. Of interest in the Roswell case. Most of the books about Roswell were written hastily that year. And
how many books did you do? And that's probably not a good segue, because yours are not hastily written. But
Don Schmidt and I teamed up in 1998. This is now a year after the peak, right?
Yep.
Because most everybody else had left the field. They had written their books. Don and I wanted to continue a proactive investigation of the case. By that I mean we're not just sitting back waiting for people to drop leads in our laps. We're out there shaking the tree, and if you're not out there shaking the tree, nothing is going to happen. So we teamed up at 98. And since that team up, we have written 4 books about Roswell. 2 editions of Witness to Roswell, a book called Witness to Roswell, a book about Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And in one of the photo images I sent to you that's online there, you can see Hangar 18. It's right below the picture of Walter Hout.
Oh, yeah, number 7 under your items tonight in Radio with Pictures.
That's Hangar 8, the famous Hangar 18. That's a long story. It's true number is Hangar 23, but it's referred to as Hangar 18 because it's within a complex of 10 buildings, 18A through 18F or G or something. It's within this what they call the Building 18 complex. That's why they call it Hangar 18.
Okay.
Don and I have written 4 books, 2 editions of Witness to Roswell, Inside the Real Area 51, which is really the secret history of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and our current book that came out this year called The Children of Roswell, A 7-Decade Legacy of Fear, Intimidation, and Cover-Ups.
That's not a bad blurb. So the Children of Roswell, let's hone in on that now.
Okay.
All the people, all the 600 and some people that you guys were able to talk to over all the other books, plus all the people you never reached, they all had kids. They all grew up in this atmosphere, this milieu. They knew this story. So your book starts with their stories and what happened when they, like humans do, they tried to talk about this thing.
Yes. As we went along, with our investigation, we were increasingly talking to children and now grandchildren of the participants, because to put it in perspective, Richard, if you were a 20-year-old airman in 1947 taking part in this recovery, next year you will be 90 years old.
Hmm.
And how many people live to be 90? Certainly more today than there used to be, but I'd say that 98% of the participants in the 1947 recovery are now gone. They're either gone or suffering the maladies of old age, and you cannot interview them.
Right.
So thus, the children and grandchildren assume a greater importance than if the original participants were still alive.
Well, look at what happened with Marcel. Marcel's son, came back from that ranch, and some of the debris, he had it apparently in his car, and he brought it into the kitchen.
Yes.
And he woke up his 11-year-old son to look at this stuff, and that stayed with that 11-year-old kid till he died. So talking to the children, when you're at that age, if something really weird's going on, it's going to make a mark in your life you're never going to forget. So going in through the doorway of the children is a whole new look at this whole amazing story.
Yes, and also the children might be disposed to talk where the parent would not.
Mm.
We've had cases of that. But you're absolutely right. Jesse Marcel Jr., I believe, was 11 years old at the time. And you've met Jesse.
Mm-hmm.
He is a doctor, ear, nose, and throat doctor. He's gone now about 2 years. But lieutenant colonel in the Air Force. And
this time hopping back and forth is confusing, I know.
Yes, just a great guy. You know that. You've met him. He is just I can't imagine him fabricating anything.
No.
And he is one of the witnesses to this wreckage that his father brought home that night back from the crash site. He was on his way back to the base. It's like early in the morning, 2 a.m. Maybe he had to go to the bathroom. I don't know. But he stopped at home.
I have a feeling he wanted to show his 11-year-old son.
Yes, I was just trying to. That is absolutely right. That is absolutely right.
You know, they used to say the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. Look at Marcel Jr., and then you can imagine his father. And
yes.
What he if he had something so amazing. You know, little pieces of metal you could crinkle up and they would snap back into perfect shape. That had to be in 1947 sci-fi.
Yes, it still is. But that's right. And he brought in a box of the wreckage. And according to Jesse Jr., they tried to piece it together into some, see if they could see what it might look like, but they couldn't. But the key there is that Jesse described this one piece of wreckage. It's a 18-inch long I-beam. If you look at its side, you know, cross-section like a layer cake,
right.
It's shaped like an I. But in between the lips were these strange symbols. And he didn't, you know, he just said, well, I can't read this. I don't know what that is. And it was, we still don't know what the purpose of this I-beam was, but it was light as a feather and indestructible and all that, but it had this strange writing or symbology.
They were described as hieroglyphs, but they looked nothing like Egyptian hieroglyphs.
Correct, correct. As we understand it, they actually brought in linguists and code breakers and stuff like that to try to decipher these strange symbols on this I-beam, but nobody could because they didn't have any point of reference. And no, they were not able to decipher it into any meaningful thought or phrase or sentence or anything like that. So, but Jesse described that, and when he tells you that, you believe him. I don't believe he is capable.
We're talking about Jesse Marcel Jr. now. Tom, do we lose you?
Linda,
there you are. We're having a couple of problems with Skype here. Someone sent me a note, did it affect electronics? We're near them. No, but it's affecting our electronics now. Tom, are you there? Earth to Tom. Okay. I think we lost Tom. Oh, that's a shame. Let's see if we
okay,
can
get... I'm still here.
There you are.
What's the question?
What's the answer? No, I was thinking that Jesse Marcel Jr. is describing his father getting him out of bed, showing him this stuff. He was one of the first children of Roswell.
Jesse Marcel.
Yes. Jesse Junior, Marcel Jr., yeah.
Yes. So the other thing that Jesse told us was that his father, when he came back that evening or early in the morning, he said that even at that point, his father believed that it was from one of these flying saucers.
Really?
He believed that this wreckage was from a flying saucer. That even that early in the proceedings, he believed it was from a flying saucer.
Okay, this was in July, right?
Yes, this is in July.
From June to July, the papers all over the country had these screaming headlines. That's your mosaic up at the top of Radio with Pictures.
Yep.
So if he got something that was not anything he was familiar with, I mean, he was an intelligence guy, right? He knew aircraft, every technology. He was supposed to be aware of foreign technologies, foreign aircraft. If he had something in the trunk of his car that was he could handle it, and it was not familiar, no wonder he thought it might be one of these things that the papers were covering.
Because he was familiar with all of that stuff. He also had recently had a course in meteorology, and which included weather balloons. So he knew it wasn't a weather balloon. But he, according to Jesse Jr., his father believed that it was from one of these so-called flying saucers that people were seeing during the last 2 weeks. So...
Okay.
And Jesse Sr. died in 1986, I believe. I never met him, but certainly I knew Jesse Jr. So he was one of the first children of Roswell. A second one is still alive. She was 12 years old in 1947. Her name is Frankie Dwyer Rowe. Her father was Dan Dwyer, a city fireman, who had gotten out to the crash site and had seen the bodies.
Oh, my God.
He'd seen the wreckage, and he had seen the bodies, and he had encountered one that was still alive.
By the way, you're kidding.
No.
One was still alive? Okay, if you want to see a picture of this fireman's daughter, Frances Dwyer Rowe, image number 10 in Radio with Pictures under Tom's section tonight.
She's the one just past Barry Goldwater.
Yeah, number 10.
Yep. That I took that picture about 3 years ago. She's still alive. Know her well. And she not only knew the story from her father when he got home that night, you know, what happened today, Dad?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I just happened to visit a crash site north of town that had a flying saucer and some dead bodies, and one was still alive. You know, one was still alive. What did it look like? So he described what it looked like. You know, your standard 3.5 foot tall, frail body with a large pear-shaped head, wide-set eyes, slightly slanted, little slit for a mouth, two little holes in the front of the face for where the nose would be, and two holes in the side of the head where our ears would be.
This is what Frances' father, the fireman, is telling her when he comes back from the site.
Correct.
Okay, and hold it there. We're at the bottom of the hour, and it's a very good time to take a pause, because when we come back, we're going to talk about the other children of Roswell, some amazing stories here, about how far the reach of government can be when the government doesn't want you to know something. They don't forget. They pursue. They do not leave you alone. This is an amazing story and an amazing book. So we'll come back with my guest of the morning, Tom Carey. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return. And we are back on The Other Side of Midnight, 1.5 hour to go. If you want to join the conversation, remember, go to theothersideofmidnight.com, go to the upper left-hand corner, click on Facebook or Twitter, and join the conversation that way, and we'll send me over anything interesting that you have to ask or say, a comment, a piece of information, someone from Roswell who's a children of Roswell who knows something that no one else knows. Or you can call us, 505-796-8802, 505-796-8802, or on Skype, you're the Enterprise Mission, or The Other Side of Midnight. You can reach us all those different ways, but Facebook probably is the easiest because that way you get to chat with a bunch of other people who are also asking very interesting questions. So, Tom, please continue.
Yes, so Frankie Rowe is at home with her family, and they're asking her father about this creature that he had seen at the crash site that day, and he described it as I did a few minutes ago. And well, the next thing they wanted to know was, she said, "Well, did you talk to it?" Hmm. And he said, "Well, yes, I did. But we talk to each other, not like we're talking now with our using our mouth and our lips and our tongue and our vocal cords. We talk to one another in our heads."
Oh, my God. He told her that?
Yes.
How old was she when her dad had this experience?
She's 12 years old at that time.
So she's a year older than Marcel Jr., so she's a lot, and she's a girl, so girls are smarter at that age anyway.
Yes.
So she's
absolutely
really remembering this.
Yes.
Wow.
And what did you talk about? That was the next one. Well, you know, if you talk to him, what did you talk about? And he said, it was very interesting. He said, because when I saw it, I felt sorry for it. And it told me not to worry about, I'll call it it. We don't know if it was male, female, or even if they had gender.
Right.
It said, don't worry about me. My comrades are dead. My ship is destroyed, and there's no way I can get back home. But don't worry about me. I accept my fate. That was essentially the message. And then the military drove up, and that was the end of the conversation.
Hmm.
So but what happened was—
Now, wait. Her father never told this story publicly.
No, he died in 1959. From a heart attack, massive heart attack, which is 12 years later, but he never talked publicly about it. But he told the family that night, and what I was about to say is that the very next day, there's a knock on the door. Her father's at work, and it's just Frankie Dwyer then, and her mother at home. And it's this tall, broad-shouldered Air Corps officer named Arthur Philbin. I won't go into it, how we know it was a fellow by the name of Arthur Philbin, but he was a first lieutenant, and he's at the door with two other NCOs. He had two NCOs with him.
Hmm.
And Frankie Rowe had described them as thugs, thuggish looking.
Wait a minute. She's a 12-year-old kid in an era when people worshiped the military because they saved us from World War II.
Yes.
And she said they were thugs at 12 years old?
She said that, no. She told us this today, you know.
No, but thinking back, that was her impression then. What gave her that impression?
Her impression was that they were burly, thuggish looking. The thuggish, I'm sure, was a later description.
Right.
I don't know what she thought of them back then.
Well, she obviously had an aversion to them, and this is so interesting because kids at that age were raised to be worshipful of the military.
Yes. Well, he asked to come in, and so he came in, and the two NCOs took the mother into the kitchen, and the first lieutenant, Arthur Philbin, took Frankie Dwyer into the living room. And he started off by saying, oh, I forgot to mention that she also had handled a piece of the wreckage the previous day at the firehouse because she had been in town for a dental visit. And when the dentist was finished, she went to the firehouse to wait for her father to take her home. And while she was waiting there, the police officer came in, highway patrolman.
Mm-hmm.
He said, "Hey, fellas, look what I got." He reached in his pocket, took out a piece of this, what we call memory metal. "Richard, this is that metal that you can wad up in your hand, and it'll crunch up, and then you open up your hand, and it'll just unfurl itself and put it down to the table."
I think the best simulation of this was in that brief TV series called Dark Skies.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Where he's showing the piece to Robert Kennedy, I think, and it's very good, very good effects in that TV series.
Well, that's what she described. Well, this Arthur Phil.
So this was like all over town. People were just rubbing into each other and saying, "Hey, look at this! Look at that kind of thing."
Yes, and the Air Force. I'm sorry, the Air Corps at that time. They're trying to get a hold of it. They are trying to get a hold of this story.
This reminds me of a movie. It's a mad world. Can you imagine the Army Air Corps and all the civvies and the cops and the fire guys, and everybody's at cross purposes because they've got an exciting thing. But the government wants to keep everything quiet. So what did they basically took them and separated them in their house, and he what? He threatened this 12-year-old girl?
First he said, "What you saw, you didn't see." And she says, "Oh, yes, I did."
Oh, my.
Well, he took out his baton, and he started every sentence he made, every point he made, he slapped his baton in his hand, sort of an exclamation point. He says, "Okay. If you ever talk about this, you are never to talk about this again. And if you do, we will take you and your family out into the desert, and no one will ever see you again. It's a big desert out there, and no one will ever see you or the rest of your family again," with the threat being that they would be killed.
Hmm.
Well, she never spoke about that again until the Randall and Schmidt team in the early 90s, spoke with her.
No wonder she thought they were thugs.
Yes, yes. Well, and the thing was, every time she would talk about this, her eyes would tear up. But there's a happy ending here, Richard, and it's reported in our book for the first time, is that the son of Arthur Philbin called Frankie. Now, Arthur Philbin, we tried to track him down. He was a former New York City detective, and they told us that, he died in the 1950s or 60s. Well, we said, okay, well, that was wrong. He retired to Nebraska. He didn't go back to Brooklyn or New York. He retired to Nebraska. He had a son named James, and James called up Frankie one day about 3 years ago. He didn't tell her who he was, other than he was a friend that he would like to meet with her.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he shows up one day, 3 years ago, knock on the door, and there he is, James Philbin, son of Arthur Philbin. He's got a big bouquet of flowers for Frankie. "May I come in?" And, of course, in Roswell, they're fairly friendly, and so she invited him in.
They still don't lock their doors, Tom. Seriously.
Right. That's true.
I've been there.
They only got electricity up around Corona in the 1980s.
Amazing.
So anyway,
this total stranger who's not, because she knows who he is, but he shows up unannounced with a bouquet of flowers.
He shows up unannounced. She don't know who he is. And he says, "My father wanted you to have this.
Oh,
he is sorry for what he did back in 1947. "Well, who are you?" "My name is James Philbin. My father was Arthur Philbin, and he was the officer."
Tom, think about this. You're an Air Force guy. You're a Boy Scout. You grew up on all the flag stuff, and you just won the war, and you're part of an elite. And, think of what they felt like back then. They were giants. They had saved the world for democracy. And then you're instructed to go and threaten with death a 12-year-old kid. If you're anybody, it must really burn in your consciousness. And this demonstrates that it did affect him. It did. He was not a robot. He was someone ordered to do an awful job because it was so important that this secret never get out.
Yes. So important.
Good men being instructed to do bad things.
Yes. So important was the secret. And
you don't do that for a weather balloon.
They don't do that for a weather balloon. They don't do that for a weather balloon or a string of weather balloons.
No.
And after that, say a month or two later, they also enlisted the sheriff of Chavez County, where Roswell was the county seat, and the base was located in Chavez County, just south of the town of Roswell. Because the sheriff was fluent in Spanish, his name was George Wilcox, they enlisted him to deliver the death threat message to locals, especially the Hispanics who lived in.
How do you get good Americans to do this to other Americans back then?
Wilcox, before he died, he said it was the biggest. He told his daughters and his wife it was the biggest mistake he ever made was to when the rancher Mac Brazel first came into town with the wreckage. He went to the sheriff's office, and the sheriff directed him. Well, it looks like that stuff on your ranch came from the sky. So anything that comes from the sky is the purview of the Air Corps.
Hmm.
And so he directed Brazel. he actually called the base. He called, and he got Jesse Marcel. He said, I have a fellow here with some strange wreckage here. Maybe you want to come out here and look at it. Mm. And he said that was the biggest mistake. He should have gone first to the media because then it wouldn't have been covered up. At least that's what he said.
But going to
the base, he said they covered it up. And if he had gone to the media first, they never would have done that. Who knows, but that's what he said.
So, now, included in the children of Roswell would be technically Mac Brazel's son, right?
Yes.
What happened to him? There's a weird story around him.
Yes. Mac Brazel had, let me see, there was Bill Jr., Paul, and Vernon. He had three sons and one daughter, Bessie Brazel.
This is the ranch foreman who found all this junk, mile long, 300 feet wide on a sheep ranch that he managed. And he brought pieces of it into town. He went to the sheriff. The sheriff sent him to the Air Corps and said in later years it was the biggest mistake he ever made. So, but Mac also has a couple of sons?
Yes. One son, Paul, was in he worked in Texas, so he was more or less out of the picture. Bill Jr. was just married. He was living in Albuquerque, and he first got the story reading about it in the Albuquerque Journal. And he said, looks like Pop's in trouble. Let's get down to Corona. The ranch was near Corona.
Right.
And the youngest son was listed in the first press release as being out at the ranch with his father and sister. And actually, Vernon, who was 8 years old, who we're talking about here, was at the ranch house, which was actually 10 miles from the crash site. So he never did get to the crash site himself, and neither did his sister Bessie.
Oh, too bad.
But what had happened to him was that in 1960 this is now 13 years after the event, Vernon, his car is found in Grants, New Mexico.
Which is west of us near the Arizona New Mexico border on Route 40. Okay.
Yes. He's just he had joined the Navy. He's out of the Navy. It's 1960. He's working in Grants. His car is found unoccupied. And where's Vernon? Vernon has disappeared. And it turns out his work checks were he never picked up his check from work. He never told his family. He is gone from the face of the earth. Well, the family had by that time had moved to Alaska. They come back down. Where's Vernon? They're looking. They give up. They go to the Grants police They said, well, we don't appreciate you coming here, but our conclusion is he must have drowned fishing.
Wait. They told the family they didn't appreciate them coming?
Yes, they treated them like they were hostile.
They were hostile aliens. He must have talked in a bar.
Something. He's gone. The police are covering up. They say, well, he probably drowned fishing. Well, you know, I don't know what. I guess the Rio Grande ran through there or something. I don't know. But that's it. They never hear from him again until 2002. There's this woman from Helena, Montana, calls. She had her husband had passed away some years before, and she's applying for Social Security herself. And she uses his Social Security number, and instead of coming up the name that he was going by, it came up Vernon Brazel. This is now 2002. Vernon had gone to Helena, Montana, gotten a new name, Edward Tannehill, something like that, and married this woman. And 6 years later, I'm sorry, 7 years later, 1967, he was a heavy drinker, had fits of depression. 7 years later, 1967, he puts a gun to his head and kills himself.
Oh, my.
Well, in 2002, she's trying to get Social Security, and up comes not the name of her husband, but Vernon Brazel with this Social Security number of her husband.
Oh, my.
She says, who is this? So her daughters, they did a Google search, and they found a Brazel living in Portland, Oregon. It turned out to be Bessie Brazel's son, who's they gave him the first name of Brazel. And so she contacted him, and she says, who is Vernon Brazel? Well, that's my brother.
Oh, my God.
And so she comes down to Roswell, meets with Bessie Brazel. I'm sorry, with the people down at the museum, and she's trying to find out who Vernon Brazel is. He had disappeared, and she never knew that he was Vernon Brazel, Mac Brazel's son. He was Edward Tannehill, and he was, I don't know what he did for a living up in Montana, but he had a tattoo in his arm that said Vernon. And she said, well, who's Vernon? Oh, well, that's one of my nephews.
Mm.
That's one of my nephews.
So sometime after the events, he was so traumatized, he literally left town and moved to another state and changed his name.
Yes.
Do we trace this back to the Roswell incident or to, I mean, look, people have all kinds of strange things in their families, so who knows if it's directly.
He never mentioned the Roswell incident, but like a number of other witnesses, he was a heavy drinker. And,
well, if he had been threatened with death by a sheriff or an army guy or whatever, you know, when you're 8 years old and someone basically who you idolize, an authority figure, you know, watch TV, watch cop shows, watch, you know, Cowboys and Indians, and suddenly one of your heroes turns and says, if you don't keep your mouth shut, we're going to kill you. That'll really make your day go.
We also believe that happened to D. Proctor, who was the son. He was a year younger than Vernon at the time, and he most likely had seen the wreckage as well. He was with Mac Brazel, actually, the morning he found it. He was also threatened. He never talked about it. He was a heavy drinker, and when we talked to his mother, Loretta, she said, well, you know, we would get out of D, and it probably happened to Vernon as well, is that they saw something that they shouldn't have seen.
Mm.
They saw something that they shouldn't have seen, and they were threatened with their lives. D never talked about it. Whenever we would try to interview him, we'd go in the front door, and he'd run out the back door. So we never really did have a sit-down with him.
That's a shame.
And Vernon we never did because he disappeared in 1960, moved to another state, got a new name, married, and committed suicide. And it was really strange. The family, he never contacted the family when he disappeared. That he was up here in Montana, doing this or that. Nothing. Mm. Nothing. So,
well, obviously, all this disruption of families and all this, you know, ripples through the time, whatever, doesn't happen just because of a weather balloon. Darren has joined the conversation. Darren, what's up? What do you want?
I think it's despicable how the military treated all the people of Roswell. They had disclosure for one day, and nobody freaked out. You know, everybody was happy about it. They were like, this is interesting. They were sharing the pieces, and this really happened. Imagine if they, you know, didn't make a big deal about it. I wonder how if the town of Roswell could handle it, why couldn't we handle it?
The thing that's interesting is that we often get the question, why did they cover it up? And the best answer that we received actually came from the daughter, another children of Roswell, child of Roswell, the daughter of one of the airmen. He was a major out at the base, Major Patrick Saunders. He was the base adjutant, one of the direct reports to the commander. And when we first called him in the early 90s, he said, oh, you're chasing aliens, little green men, boop, 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 you know. Well, turns out that when he was near death in 1995, he bought up copies of Randall and Schmidt's second book, The Truth About the UFO Crash at Roswell, and signed his name to it, to a passage in the book that talked about what really went on. And he said, atop of this passage, this is what really happened, and I haven't told anybody yet. And he signed it Patrick Saunders. And he sent that out to friends and relatives, signed like that.
Wow.
Well, we interviewed his daughter later, and she told us that when she found out her father was involved in this, she said, well, Dad, why did you cover this up? And he told her, according to the daughter, we were faced with a technology greater than our own, and we didn't know what their intentions were. So in the military mindset, if you don't know the answer to something, you cover it up. Because you don't want to give the appearance that you cannot fulfill your mission. And the mission of the Air Corps, the Air Force, is to have control of our skies. And with the case
of... Yeah, but that's Tom, that's not an Air Force precept or an Army or a Navy or whatever. That's obviously this intrusive politicization of this went against all the military mindset, which was you don't go and threaten 12-year-old kids.
Well, that's what they did. That's
because they were ordered. They were just following orders.
Oh, yes. This was they were ordered, certainly. And it just to me, it proves the point of how important it was to them to keep it quiet.
Yeah, Darren, anything else?
Is this why the CIA was made in 47?
In 1947, yes, it was the I forget the Security Act of 1947, where the OSS, which had become the Central Intelligence Group, in September of 1947, became the Central Intelligence Agency.
Yeah, this was the act that Truman signed in 47.
Yes,
it was the beginning of the end.
Yep,
the military-industrial complex run amok.
Hmm.
All right.
Yeah. Threatening 12-year-old kids with a big desert.
Yep.
Tom, I think this is a very important book. Darren, thank you. Anything else?
Nope.
Okay.
Good night.
Later. Tom, this is a very important book because you're now tracing through generations the psychological ripple effect of a government with a heavy boot basically deciding what we can and cannot know.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. We have a question from Twitter I want to get in here before we are leaving. We've only got about 2 minutes left. Of all the witnesses you've talked to, this is from Voluntary Exchange, what's the most interesting or compelling testimony have you got?
Oh, wow.
And you only got 2 minutes.
Wow, that is a good question. Well, you know, Richard, we have over 600 witnesses, first and second hand. I would say the key witnesses, certainly Jesse Marcel Sr., Walter Hout. We knew Walter Hout. He was the officer who put out the press release.
The public affairs officer for the Air Force.
Public affairs officer.
At the Roswell base.
We put together a, because he would never talk beyond that to us, but we learned a lot about him, and we put together a sealed statement for him of a number of things we believe that he was involved in, what he saw, what he did, and we gave it to him in 2003. Walter, take a look at this.
Tell you what, unfortunately, we're out of time. Tom, you got to come back. I want to know more of the stories of the children of Roswell. Go to his bio on The Other Side of Midnight, Radio with Pictures. Click on that, and we will have you back. Until tomorrow then, everyone, remember, third star on the left, straight on till morning. Good night, everyone.